Accession number 20155, Reel 2.
Harry, Keeble, Reel 2.
As I said, there were too many cooks there, so I was given another job. So I became a sort of ward master. The reason I said I found them to be lazy was the fact that I was a night ward master, and very often I couldn't find the Maltese orderlies. So I took to going around a bit earlier and counting the empty beds, and very often found them sleeping in the empty beds. They didn't like me at all. The other thing was that we had some German prisoners of war. Our barracks was in Tarfa, actually, so it was just down the road from the hospital. Which, as you know, there was always been a big British presence in Malta of the British Army. And we had the prisoners of war were kept behind in these barracks, behind sort of barbed wire. I never knew why, because the fact is that they couldn't go anywhere, really. And they were always accompanied by armed Maltese guards. And they did various jobs around the hospital. They'd obviously been captured in the Western Desert. And one night, of course, one of them committed suicide in the barracks. And I was called out. And unfortunately, I couldn't get the guards to help me to get him down. So I was very annoyed with them.
But what? You mean he'd hanged himself?
He'd hanged himself, yeah. Anyway, I managed to get him down. There was nothing I could do for him. But I disliked the Maltese intensely after that period. So I was in Malta for 10 months. And obviously I got demobbed. I came back to Aldershot to be demobbed. Of course, I had to go back to Lloyd's because actually... when I left to go in the army, I was earning 30 shillings a week. And until such time as my tradesman's pay came up to 30 shillings a week, Lloyd's were always making my 14 shillings up to 30 shillings. I think the government's more or less laid down that they were duty-bound to take you back for at least a year, and you were duty-bound to go back for at least a year. So I didn't go back into the cooking. I'd finished with cooking altogether then. I decided I'd had enough. And cooking certainly wasn't the same as when I left to go into the army. When I came back, there were too many tins and too many packages and so forth, and it wasn't cooking anymore. I left Lloyd's after a year. I was on their maintenance staff for a year. And I then went and to join the post office. I became a telephone operator. I did my training in Clerkenwell Telephone Exchange.
Clerkenwell Telephone Exchange.
Okay. That's right. I was at Clerkenwell Telephone Exchange for did my training, and then I was posted as a telephonist to Seven Kings Telephone Exchange, which is one of our local telephone exchanges. And it was a manual telephone exchange. I was in the area for about 18 years. In that period, of course, we had an association. We had night telephonists and day telephonists. The night telephonists came on duty around about 6 o'clock, and their duties extended to 8 o'clock in the morning. What we called two through nights a week, which started at 7 and ended at 8. Or you came up at 6 o'clock and went home, finished at half past 10 or 11. The post office, mainly the big union in the post office, of course, was a union of post office workers. And of course, as the telephone side actually came under the Postmaster General, they held sway. But there was another association which was called the National Guild of Telephonists. And so I then became the branch secretary of the National Guild of Telephonists for the East area. The East Area had, in those days, 18 telephone exchanges. And so here I was, we had something like, there must have been about 1,000 night telephonists scattered around the East Area. We had a London telephone region, and we had at that time 7 telephone managers areas. After a while, I was a member of the executive council. I did that for 5 years, and then later on, I became the regional council secretary, which meant I was the overall boss, if you might say that, for the telephonist to the director of London Telephone Region. I did this for a while, and then I decided that I'd had enough. And so it was near the fact that after you'd been in so many years, you were near to promotion. And so I took a temporary ASL assistant, that's an assistant supervisor, ASL. And I became an instructor at a telephone school in London Wall, teaching telephonists. Then I got the chance of becoming a temporary TTO, which is a telephone traffic officer, that is. It's a traffic officer, and which is on more or less on the staff side, management side. And I took over the running of a school for TTOs. So I was in Oxford Street for a while. Then I went to Charles House, which is opposite the Olympia. And we had, I ran in the school for a long time. We had various people coming in to do instructions to them. And by this time, we were getting round to the fact that we were now going to be independent of the post office, and the telephone service then became independent. It did become independent of them. And I was then posted to a headquarters, which at that time was in King Edward Street in London, where the Postmaster General was at the time. We have no Postmaster Generals now, but that was his headquarters as well. I then became a full TTO, temporary, and I was promoted later on to a service superintendent. My job in the main was, in those days, was we had what we called a trunk routing book, which was a very secret thing, but I was more or less its editor, and it had to be updated every week by the different changes in codes that we had. And of course, we were getting to full automation then. STD was coming in, and I was also conferences. We had conferences. I was the conference organiser, and I actually organised most of my conferences at Bournemouth. Out of season, of course, around about October time, and I would be negotiating with the hotels on the different rates and so forth. And I did this for quite a while. STD was a bit behind in its completion, and Crossbar was coming in, which meant that Strowger was out.
And that, what was that?
Strowger. Strowger was the form, the automation that came in around about 1923 in this country, I think. It was called Strowger because it was invented by an American. The story goes that his name was Strowger, and he was an undertaker. And there was a rival undertaker in the town, and the rival undertaker's daughter was the telephonist on the manual board, so all the calls that came in had to go through her. And he found that she was putting all the people who wanted an undertaker through to her father, and so he invented Strowger, which took the job away from her, because people then started dialing. How can I explain it? If you dialed something in the mechanism would go up one, And then if you dial one, the next thing, the one thing would go up, you see, until you'd completed all your dialing, and it would jog up, you see. So there was no need for an operator to put you through. It was done mechanically. Because Strowger came out, Strowger was when Crossbar came in, Strowger was out, you see. But we were still a bit behind. I did actually retire when I was 60. But because we were behind on that, they asked me to stay on. Strowger never really went out till I was 65, really. But I had enough by the time I was 64. And so I then decided that I would retire. So I retired at 64. I took job release, actually, which meant somebody came and took my job. But of course it was an undergraduate from Cambridge who was very pleased to get a job, because I think they were hardly, I mean, at that time they were having a hard time finding work. I used to go back occasionally to see the people in the office, of course. I think one of the things that was worst of all was that I was in Lutyens House. It was called Lutyens House in those days. It actually belonged to British Petroleum. It was, the building itself was designed by Lutyens. They called it Britannia House, but when we moved in, we called it, we renamed it Lutyens House. And Lutyens House was right opposite Moorgate Station. And I was there at the period when, do you remember, they had the underground crash at Moorgate when the driver went into the...
I think it was 1975.
Yeah, and so that was it. It actually shook the foundations of the house next door, which was belonged to us as well. And then I saw, we took over other premises in Finsbury Circus, which I worked in. But I think that was the worst episode of the fact that you, with the Moorgate train disaster. I had quite a good time.
You didn't attend the train disaster, did you?
Sorry?
You didn't attend the scene of the disaster.
Well, no, we all went out to try and give blood, actually, because I was a blood donor, so... I donated blood until I was 60, actually, because the post office had their own set-up, and we used to go to King Edward Building every now and again to give blood, at least twice a year. So I retired at 64. Well, of course, my mother died during the war. I should have said this earlier. My mother died during the war in 1942. She died at the age of 62. I have an elder brother. He was 7 years older than me. I have an elder sister who was 9 years older than me, and I have a younger sister who's 18 months younger than me. I came back home. I went back to my own home, of course, after the war. But my father had married again, so I didn't get very well with my stepmother. And so I left, and I went into with a friend to live with a friend for a while. And Dennis, who's now known as my foster brother. He was one of the people I met at Lloyd's, because he worked at Lloyd's. And he said that his mother would take me in, and I came here in 1948. And I've been in the house ever since. Mother died a year after I retired. And so I was left looking after my foster father, who was blind, and I looked after him for 5 years. So my retirement was a bit edgy. Didn't see too much of life. And my father was a lighterman, actually, on the Thames. My foster father is, I must say that, because my father was anything and everything. He was a lighterman, and I don't know what lightermen do, but they used to row the barges up and down the Thames. And of course he was exempt during the war, except that at one period apparently he was called up to go to Chatham. They took all the lightermen off the Thames and took them to Chatham. This is around about the time of the invasion. And unfortunately it left them a bit short on the Thames of The job of the Titan in those days was taking cargo off the ships, putting it in the barges and taking it further up the river. And so he was put in the Navy, and he always tells me they were known as the Brown Boot Navy because Lightermen always wore brown boots. So they didn't have any black boots for them when they got there, so they always wore their brown boots. So they're known as the Brown Boot Navy. But later on, of course, they had to send them back to their own jobs because they got short of Lightermen. So that was his short service. Dennis is my foster brother. He was called up in 1949 and did his national service in the Royal Air Force.
How do you feel now about having served in the RAMC in the Second World War?
Well, I think it war changed everything for all of us, actually. In respect, I think if it hadn't been for the war, I would have still been cooking somewhere. I think it changed us mentally, and it certainly gave me an insight on lots of things that I didn't know. It certainly improved my education. I can remember that I used to read, I used to read Sexton Blake quite a lot in those. I think it was my reading output at that time. And we had, in the 20th FDS, we had an Austrian Jew. His name was actually Bentheimer, but he called himself Benton, which is the thing that Jews did that were serving in the forces. They changed his name. So he was called Benton. And he actually introduced me to other writers. He introduced me actually to Henry Williamson. Henry Williamson wrote Tartka the Otter. But he actually wrote Chronicles of a set of books called Chronicles of Ancient Sunlight, in which he is a character called Philip Madison. But Philip Madison is actually Henry Williamson. And of course it's Henry Williamson's life, because Henry Williamson was born in Sydenham in Kent. And he worked in the city for an insurance firm, and he joined the Territorials. And of course he went to war in 1914 and had a good time. And he came back to England on leave and so forth. And then later on he got a commission, and he was a captain in the Transport Corps. And of course he writes about his experience of losing mules and men in the mud. I'm telling you this because, in actual fact, and it's one of the things I actually do at the museum, is that I take people down to 1914 and tell them about the First World War. But one of the things I tell them is the fact that my mother had three sisters and four brothers. And two of my mother's brothers were killed in the First World War. And my father had three brothers, and one of his brothers was killed in the war. So you had eight people who were all in the war, of which two, so it's a quarter of each family, really. So I emphasise that. But at the same time, nobody would ever talk to you about the First World War. You'd walk around the streets and you'd see people shell-shocked, you know, be shaken and so forth. And in particular, where we used to go, there was a place called Bromley by Way Town Hall. On the stairs, there was a picture of a VC who actually lost his life saving a child from being run over. He was a bus driver. He got out of his bus for the almost everybody. In those days, everything stopped at 11 o'clock on the 11th of November. And he got out of the bus, but a lorry was still going, and the child went to run in front of it. And he actually lost his life saving the child. So, you know, nobody would ever talk to you about the war. You couldn't get them to talk about it at all. But Henry Williamson was my insight on the First World War. And, of course, since then I've had to read so many things. It was later on, of course, that I found out I was in France in 1940, actually.
Why do you think the First World War veterans were so unwilling to speak about their experiences?
I've never found out, really. it was so horrific. I always tell people that it's my war was bad enough, but this was even worse. If you think about the mud and so forth, and if you read Henry Williamson's account of these things, it gives you an insight of what it was like. I mean, don't forget the generals, but they lost so many lives unnecessarily. It's hard to think that anybody would talk about it. They really did experience something that we never experienced in our war. I call it our war.
What was so bad about your experiences in the Second World War? What were the worst things?
Well, I suppose the worst thing was the amount of casualties that we had brought into us, as far as I was concerned. We had some very, very bad cases at times. I mean, I can remember that I was doing operating theatre duty at Lillibond, and we had a dispatch rider brought in, a DR dispatch rider, and he had been, it was just outside Le Havre actually, he'd gone over a mine, and when he came in, we had to take off both his arms and both his legs, and he was blind, and it was just like having a sack of potatoes on the operating table. I'm pleased to say that he didn't survive the night. I don't think anybody would have liked to have had him over in that condition. But that was the worst. That was the worst thing I ever saw. I mean, I saw a lot of badly wounded people, but that was the worst. That was the worst. But don't forget... Sorry?
Carry on.
Don't forget, it was even worse in the First World War for some people, because obviously the medical standards weren't as good in those days as they are now.
How did men in general, from what you observed, cope with the wounds which they received?
They coped quite well, actually. I can remember, it was later on I did actually go to St Andrews to do a bit of nursing, because I thought I'd be into going the nursing service. But, I mean, I had people come in there moaning and groaning with small wounds, and I used to say to them, I've seen people with their legs off not making as much noise as you, but that's the extent of it. They didn't moan or groan, they just took it. They just took it. I suppose the worst bit is... The worst thing, I think, is when you see how young some of them were that died. That was the worst thing.
And were you also treating the enemy?
Oh, we treated the enemy in some places, yes. We had the Hitler Youth. We had the Hitler Youth. Of the... Who were arrogant little sods, if I may say that. But they soon got put in their place.
So they were even arrogant to the people?
They're arrogant to the people looking after them, yes. Very arrogant.
What form did their arrogance take?
Oh, well, they would spit at you. Well, you got clipped round the ear from me. No, they'd spit at you. They're very, very arrogant. Very arrogant. But of course, it had been drilled into them, you see.
Even when they needed help?
Oh, yes.
Did any of the Germans seem grateful?
Oh, some of them did. Some of the elderly people did. I mean, you had a mixture of young and old there. And you were also treating people who were non-Germans, people who had been drafted into the army from various parts of... We treated a few Russians at one time in Normandy.
What were they like?
Well, no, they were quite good. They were pleased to get out of it, actually. Very pleased.
Did you ever find it difficult to cope with the job?
No, I'm not really. I wouldn't say that I did. No, I'm not really. I think we'd been trained to do jobs, and I think we took it as it came along. There was no way you're going to say, I won't do this, I won't do that, because that isn't drilled into you. I mean, you've got to have discipline, and that's one of the things that they drill into you in the first place. Without discipline, you're nothing.
How did you get on with the doctors or surgeons whom you were working alongside?
Oh, they were okay. We had some very nice chief people, actually. Very nice people indeed. I didn't get on with one of my first officers. That was the one that a Major Knight. I didn't. He was called Tiger Knight. I only found out why he was called Tiger because it comes from the Tiger burning bright. he actually got killed in the desert because the First Armoured Division became a part of the Eighth Army. They went into the desert. So I could have been in the desert, you know, if I hadn't been posted. He was the only person I never got, but other than that, I got on very well with all our officers. They were very, very good. Very good indeed. We had some absolutely marvellous surgeons. We also had an Austrian surgeon amongst our lot. He was very, very good. Of course, you see, a lot of the Austrians, Jews and things have been come over here, so...
So, in Northwest Europe, in 44-45, do I understand that you were with the 20th Field Dressing Station?
Yes.
Which was part of the 52nd Division?
Yeah, yes. We were part of a beach group. That's why we had to stay on the beaches. I was in the 6th Beach Group, which attached to the 3rd Armoured, 3rd Div, 3rd Infantry Div. We were attached to the 3rd Infantry Div. So we were a part of... Because there were lots of beach groups all up and down all the beaches, you see. So you would have 1st, 2nd and so forth. And I think the beach groups went up to... there might have been 20 or 24 beach groups as far as the British were concerned on their 3 beaches. So you covered the various sectors as a beach group, you see. I don't know if you've seen photographs of the most famous one is... if you see someone with a white band around his helmet, he was a part of a beach group. He didn't go off the beach, he was around on the beach. The beach group sign, of course, that's that one up there. Can you see in the corner the blue and red thing on that white certificate there? Can you see it?
Yes, I can see that.
Yeah, well, that's a beach group sign. This is what we wore. We wore that sign on us. You can see that a bit more in a moment. That's what we wore. We were part of a beach group. So we stayed on and around the beaches for all that period, you see. Of course, we were taking in casualties during the time from Richmond, the battle like Richmond and Goodwood, which were the 2 battles that Monty set up to try and take Caen. We had quite a few cases of, we didn't call them shell shock in those days, they were called battle exhaustion cases. They were treated much differently because we had a psychiatrist with every unit. Our particular one was as mad as a hatter, he had to have a slit trench dug deeper than anybody else's.
Why?
I don't know. I always found psychiatrists to be a little bit balmy anyway.
What symptoms did battle exhaustion cases show?
Oh, well, they were shaking and so forth. In fact, it's the only time I've had a cigarette in my mouth, actually, because we had one young lad, he was shaking so badly. He wanted to light a cigarette and he couldn't do so I lit it for him, and it's about the only time I've had a cigarette in my mouth, actually. They were very bad. We had the most of them in from Goodwood and so on. And they're only 18, you know. 18, you know. They just turned 18. Because they'd lowered the age of conscription, you see.
Why do you think some people showed the symptoms of battle exhaustion and not others?
Well, I think it's much the same as it was in the First World War, because it was mostly the noise and the shelling and things like that. Don't forget, they were under very heavy pressure in respect of shelling. If you read the histories of those 2 battles, they were under very heavy pressure. Very heavy pressure. So it would have, I mean, at that young age, it would have caused them to have some sort of breakdown.
So how were they treated, apart from giving them cigarettes?
Well, we treated them with, they were given some sort of calming down tablets and things that we had in those days. They were interviewed by the psychiatrist, of course. If they were too bad, they were sent home. But otherwise, sometimes they just returned to the unit. It depends on, they just needed calming down, that's all.
Were you present when the psychiatrist...
Oh,